comments.
Oh, okay, so I'm gonna start. I prepared a formal talk. I don't know the format here, so if you have questions, you're welcome to interrupt. We can discuss, but I do have plenty of material to present to occupy the whole time period for the talk. By the way, I'm a former theoretical physicist, so this place occupies a very special place in my mind, because this is one of these elite institutes in this field. And also, I'd like to thank Andy and Jenny for giving me this opportunity to present some of the work we have been doing in the past 10 years. So let me first explain the title, so you know what this phrase all stands for. First of all, let me say this neural oscillations, what do we mean by that? So usually if you look at record from electrical, using electrical activity as your measurements, and especially if you record from some population level activities, not single neuron level, then the brain is really replete with all kinds of rhythmic activities. For instance, if you close your eyes, sitting in a quiet room, you put electrodes at the back of your head, you will see prominent oscillatory events in the field potentials at the 10 hertz range. But if you open your eyes, begin to explore the surroundings, all of a sudden those oscillations diminish, and sometimes they completely disappear. So there are many other different kind of oscillatory events in the brain. In fact, the oscillatory events are so prominent in all kinds of frequency range, there are even terminologies for them. For instance, if the oscillation is from 1 to 3 hertz, that's called a delta oscillation or delta wave. 3 to 8 hertz, that's called a theta wave. 8 to 15 hertz, that's an alpha wave. 15 to 30 is beta. 30 and above, sometimes called a gamma. In our work, we've been focusing on oscillations in the somewhat low frequency range, usually below 50 hertz. But there are records, I have seen that people have seen 500 hertz burst in the brain, recorded from different places. So that's the kind of signals that we'll be looking at. In particular, we want to look at oscillatory activity in the brain and whether that has any functional significance. This network analysis means that usually when you have neural oscillations, it tends to involve more than just one neuron. It tends to involve large ensemble of neurons. Even many different areas in the brain are cooperating underlying this particular oscillation. So in that case, in order to capture a bigger, more comprehensive picture, we tend to record from different locations simultaneously. Then we can evaluate their statistical relations with one another and how that relation change as the functions evolve. So that's these two terms. This Granger causality, I will spend much more time later on discussing it, so I will leave that for the later. The framework, the outline of my talk will be the following. I will give you a little bit of the framework for our analysis. This framework is more in the sense of a statistical analysis framework, not a theoretical in the sense of a neuroscience. But later on, I will take this framework and apply to two experimental situations. In the first case, we will look at simultaneous recordings from different parts of the brain in macaque monkeys when the monkeys are performing a visual motor task. Second experiment, I will look at also macaque monkeys field potential recordings during an intermodal selective attention task. Later on, I will explain what this term actually means for the audience who are not working in this kind of areas. If I have time, I will give a little bit further discussions about how to extend the Granger causality to a nonlinear processes. So our tools of network analysis really are composed of the following set of quantities. First of all, as I said, our main object of interest is really neural oscillations. Oscillations, by its very nature, are defined in the frequency domain. Depending on which frequency they are, events tend to be rhythmic. So therefore, a natural set of tools for analyzing oscillations are actually spectral tools. So our first tool will be a power spectrum. This is your very mundane traditional power spectrum. This will allow us to decompose a recorded signal into its frequency content so that we can examine at what frequency the signal has particularly stronger energy concentration. Once we're able to identify oscillatory activity based on single time series analysis using power spectra, then we can go a step further by looking at pair of time series, pair of recorded signals, by looking at the statistical interdependence between the signals at the different frequencies. This quantity will be accomplished by ordinary coherence, which is basically take the Fourier transform at a given frequency of two signals and perform a cross-correlation in the spectral domain. That's it. So therefore, that's give you a sense of whether the signals are statistically interdependent at a given frequency. This would allow us to identify whether the oscillation we observe form an oscillatory network. This network is defined in terms of statistical interdependence on one another. And sometimes when they oscillate together, they tend to support the same function. So therefore, there is a certain utility to identify all the sides that's involved in a given oscillation. Here, I want to mention that it's a leap going from statistical interdependence to directly infer they are functionally working together to support a given neural activity. So I like to, it's running out of power. Oh, yeah. Yesterday I was talking to Andy and and Bruno. I mentioned that I'd like to paraphrase a Hebbian learning phrase. In Hebbian learning, people always say that when neurons are firing together, they are wired together. So that's what they talk. So here I tend to say if they vary together, then they function together. So it's a somewhat of a leap, but it's some utility to it. I want to mention that this ordinary coherence, just like a correlation coefficient between two random variables, is a directionless measure. That is, when A is correlated with B, B is equally correlated with A. Sometimes, in particular in neural situations, we tend to think that certain areas tend to play a more dominant role in a given network than the others. So in other words, maybe the oscillation originates in some places, and the other places who are participating in this oscillation are just the recipients of that input. So to evaluate that situation a little further, we introduce this notion of Granger causality. So this is a notion that allows us to look at the relations between pair of time series in a little further way, that is to see whether there's a driving, whether there's a dominant influence from one to the other or back. So therefore, we want to, in other words, the temptation to add an arrow between two brain locations overwhelming in many cases. So this is a sort of feeling the need for that. The fourth quantity here is not a statistical variable. Instead, it's an analysis strategy that would allow us to address the rapid change in the functional state in the brain during a task performance. Just imagine that you do a simple visual motor task. You see something, you have to decide what you have to respond to that thing. Through this entire simple performance, the brain really goes through multiple stages. First of all, you're anticipating something's happening. Then the sensation or the photons hits your retina that triggers all this response. Then your brain receives the input and has to process this information. Then you have to decide what to do with this information. Once you decide it, then you have to make a movement in response to the decision you have made. So therefore, this entire process could be accomplished within 300-400 milliseconds. So therefore, the brain really goes through rapid transitions in its functional state. In order to capture that, we must be able to analyze the brain in very short time intervals and move this interval through so that we capture the temporal evolution. So that's our analysis strategy. So let me just spend some more time. Oh, this is out of power, so anyway. I want to spend some more time discussing the Granger causality. I know that last week Anthony Brockwell gave a lecture on that, and I will repeat some of the basics and then move on to our analysis. So at this point, I want to acknowledge Granger himself, and he's really an inspiration for us for many years. We started working on this 5 years ago. We were terribly lonely because nobody cared about what we did on this and so on. People don't feel this is something legitimate. We're really on the fringe of things. All of a sudden, he got Nobel Prize in economics, and I think that sort of gave a lot of legitimacy to this kind of analysis outside of economics. And although I did check the Nobel Committee citation for his work, it didn't mention Granger causality as the specific reason for this award. They mainly mentioned the co-integration work he did, but that's also important work as well. But I'm sure those ideas of his will find more and more applications in neuroscience as we gradually understand what these people are talking about, trying to adapt them to our neural systems. So Granger causality really stems from an earlier observation by Wiener himself. He wrote an article, The Theory of Prediction, in a book. In that article, he The article itself is very complex. It's full of measure theories. It's impenetrable. I try to read it. There's no way I can understand. But you can, in the end, he does give some kind of a sort of a idea about how he's going to approach this problem. Basically, what he's saying is the following. If you have two simultaneously recorded time series, then based on prediction alone, you can talk about the relation between the two processes in the following way. The one series is called causal to the other. If you this other series, you can achieve better prediction of this other series or the second series by incorporating knowledge of the first one. So that's basically all he said.
Better than what?
Excuse me? I will get more concrete in right away. So he didn't really tell us how to actually implement this and make it accessible actually when the data actually comes along. It's just a very general idea. Granger himself implemented the idea in terms of linear regression. That's what come to address Nisha's question regarding in what sense. So here's the specifics of Granger's idea. So say you have two time series, X and Y, simultaneously recorded. You want to build a linear prediction of your process. That is, you want to take a linear combination of a previous set of measurements, combining them with a carefully chosen set of coefficients in an optimal sense. Then you want to use this combination to predict future observation. Clearly, because we're dealing with the random processes, you're not going to predict the future exactly 100% accurate. So therefore, the future observation, this is the true observation, and your predicted observation are going to have a difference. That's captured by this error term. So therefore, the accuracy of your prediction, therefore, will be measured by the magnitude of this error term. That is, the variance of the error term is a reflection of how good is your measurement, prediction. Then he said, okay, suppose you do the same thing using the past measurement again of my own process. Now I'm also incorporating the previous measurement of the other process. Yeah.
Would you comment on the choice of M and K?
Yeah, this is all, yeah, I will come back a little bit later. Choosing the mode of order, normally speaking, in the theoretical sense, this should be all infinite order, infinite processes. But of course, in practice, you have to truncate. How to choose the mode of order is a major issue in model estimation.
Your comparison will depend on your choice of M and K.
Of course, definitely, definitely. So this, as I said, this coefficient, the model order, all choose in some optimal sense. In actual implementation, there are all ways to deal with them. So then you incorporate the Y process into it, and then you use this combination as a prediction of your future observation. Again, you're going to have an error term that captures the non-predicted part. So what he said is the following. If this error term, the magnitude of this error term is smaller than this one, then Y process has a causal influence on X. So that's the next slides. Yeah.
For K equals M, it is going to be smaller.
Not necessarily. It could be equal. No. Has to be really smaller in this strict statistical sense. That you're absolutely correct. You cannot get smaller errors, but you have you could have a situation where no improvement will result. So the statement I just made can be captured in this expression. That is, the second error is strictly less than the first error in some suitable statistical sense. If that's the case, then we will say Y series has a causal influence on X series and represented by this symbol F Y directing to X.
Just a quick question.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're just worrying about causal influence,
yeah.
Why not disperse with the X prediction and just have a predictor from Y?
Just pure predictor on Y?
Yeah.
Then how do you compare them? I mean, this notion depends on the comparison. That is, the best prediction on X, then including Y.
You have just the pure variance of X, which is unconditioned on X.
Right.
Unconditioned on Y.
Right.
And then.
X could depend on other variables.
Right.
I mean, if condition on one of them, you should get.
Well, I mean, if there's core. No, what he's saying is that just forego the previous measurement of X itself, directly predicting the current X based on the previous Y. That's it, without the current X. That could be interesting. I cannot comment on it because I'm just representing his procedure. And so I.
Is this notion restricted to linear prediction?
Yeah, this is linear prediction. But we have looked at the nonlinear extensions of it. It's very straightforward. Mm-hmm. People have looked at nonlinear extensions. It's not difficult at all. So as I said at the beginning, that so far everything is talked about in the time domain. We call this the time domain analysis because it's all based on the variable you measured it over time. And we said that we are interested in oscillation, so therefore we want a spectral equivalent of this whole idea. And Granger himself in 1969, in that big paper he wrote, he attempted a spectral decomposition of the time domain causal measures into different frequencies. But he was not able to succeed because he started on the wrong footing. So in the 70s, engineers have tried various ways of doing some work along those lines, but they're not very successful. Until 1982, John Gawicki, another economist, he really wrote a groundbreaking paper where he found a very interesting decomposition that take the time domain quantity and then express it in the spectral domain. So in other words, he have found a spectral representation of the Granger causality according to different frequencies. And he also proved the theorem which shows that if you integrate this time domain quantity over all the frequencies, you will go back to the time domain quantity. So this equality alone is very telling you something he did is right. Because if you think about what is spectral decomposition of a time series, basically you just take the variance of your time series, which is sort of the magnitude, the power of your data, and then you decompose that time series into different frequencies. In other words, your power spectrum integrated over frequencies is the time domain variance.
So I'm using something in itself is the ratio of the variances?
Yeah, those variances. Well, with a certain logarithm taken, that statistically you have to, it has to have some kind of logarithms, yes, in order for the quantities to be nice and have good statistical properties. So our work, we're concentrating on this. So we're going to compute this. This can all be very straightforwardly estimated from data, and we're going to refer to that as Granger causality spectrum. So
do you filter that at all, that spectrum?
No.
Everything?
No, everything. Yeah, decompose it naturally by itself without filtering, no. We actually are very, very cautious with the filtering because that can create all kinds of artifacts. We actually, early days, suffered greatly with filtering and get all kinds of things, and we realized it's all not true. So I know they're like Valerie, they're all statisticians. Statisticians like to see an interpretation in some meaningful sense. So basically, the statistical meaning of the Gawicki spectral decomposition can be thought of this way. That is, if you look at the power at a given frequency of a given process, then that power, he found, can be decomposed into two parts. One is called the intrinsic part. The other one is the causal part that is contributed by the causal influence from the other process. Then he defined his spectral, Granger causality spectrum, as the following quantity. That is the total power itself divided by the intrinsic part. So therefore, if the causal part is zero, the power and the intrinsic part are the same, so you get one, log one, zero. When this part is positive, it's non-zero, then this ratio will be positive, or will be greater than one, log of that is a positive number. So based on whether this thing is non-zero or not, that's the basis for doing statistical inference.
What is that definition? Is power defined in the usual way?
Power, just like take a Fourier transform at a given frequency, absolute value.
Is square?
So yeah, right. Power is the variance, right. It's the magnitude squared.
It's magnitude squared, but then I itself is the log of its power. I mean, power depends on I, right?
Power depends on the frequency. This is in the frequency domain.
I know I of f, right?
This is the I of f. This is the I of f.
But I of f is not a Fourier transform.
Yeah.
It's not. Not. Yeah, it's a Fourier transform squared and a suitably averaged.
Well, I is already squared and averaged.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. I want to mention this because I have been very embittered battle with my dear friends and Parth and Mitra over parametric approach to spectral analysis and non-parametric. We always debate every time we see each other. And I want to mention that so far as you can see that you build a linear predictor on all these things, seem to so ad hoc, like you have no other way, just do a simplest thing. But that's not actually true. You know, this is Institute Theoretical Physics, everything's ground up, first principle and so on. I want to give a first principle representation of this too. The first principle actually is really embedded in this wall decomposition theorem, Ward in the 1930s proved the following result. That is, if you have a purely stochastic process, then that stochastic process can be written as a moving average, infinite moving average. What that means is that this epsilon t is a white noise process. So they are independent at different times, and they have the same statistical property at different times, but they're just independent of one another. So you just write this is called a moving average representation of this stochastic process itself. Then if you introduce a lag operator, that is, you introduce an operator L, this L has the following property. When L sees epsilon t, it's going to retard its time units by one. See it twice, retard it by twice. So therefore, this can be written as epsilon t with L to the n in the front. So therefore, this is a power series and acting on this epsilon t. Then you formally invert it into the other side. Suppose this can be done. And then you expand this into a Taylor series as well. Then this lag operator will begin to operate on xt. So therefore, you're going to see a xt, xt minus 2, and so on. And I suppose further that the process converges rapidly, so you can truncate at some finite stage, then you will end up with this system. This is nothing but the autoregressive linear prediction I displayed earlier from the starting point. If you take all this to the other side, that's the linear combination of previous measurement predicting the current one. So therefore, this entire linear regression approach to time series modeling has a deep foundation if you accept the stochastic process as the proper framework for your analysis.
So the difference is that before you could also define it formally, you just didn't know what epsilon is. Now you say epsilon is a Gaussian.
Yeah, it's a Gaussian process, right. In this analysis, all these assumptions are made. And this, in fact, is quite true. We have looked for Gaussianness in our empirical data. They tend to be quite true.
But this interpretation assumes that X has no deterministic component.
Yes, absolutely. Purely stochastic process. Yeah, purely stochastic. Right, that's what this means, indeterministic process. And this, there's other terms called regular and so on. There are different variety of schools. They use different terms.
But in the case that we're interested in typical interpretation or not,
yeah,
it's an appropriate one, and you would have to go back to
yes.
The way you
Absolutely. Yeah.
Where there is a
right. That you have to model them separately. You have to model them separately. Yes. That's another.
You don't know whether epsilon is a Gaussian
noise. Yes. Absolutely correct. Nothing is as simple as I represent them here. So, but we do make the assumption that our data indeed is a stochastic process, coming from a stochastic process, have all these nice properties. And therefore, our approach really can be encapsulated in this one graph. We call this the adaptive multivariate autoregressive model. That is because of multivariate, because we have to model multiple time series simultaneously. We cannot model them piecemeal one at a time. So we model them at the same time. So therefore, our observation will be captured in this vector. M channels observation, that you have M sensors placed different part of the brain. Data comes out, denoted by time T, and it writes this linear autoregressive model. And then based on the data, we estimate all these coefficient matrices. Once the model is estimated from our data, data is discarded. Then we just perform analysis on this model. So that's the essential approach we're taking. So once the model is in place, you can put a transform, you get the transfer functions, all the standard linear system stuff. Then you get suitable average, you get your spectral matrix. And then the next graph shows what you can derive from this set of quantities are present on the previous slides. For example, you can perform spectral, power spectrum. Power spectrum itself already carries some neurobiological meaning. That is, the variables we are looking at are actually population variables. Sort of they are like a smeared version of a local set of neurons. So like an average version. So in other words, if you use an average version, then we realize that if the magnitude of the signal itself is already meaningful. That is, if the underlying neurons are all acting on their own, then when they add it together, they tend to cancel one another, get a very meager little signal. On the other hand, if they are all very powerfully synchronized, producing very synchronous activities, then you average them, you get a big signal. So therefore, the power themselves, especially when you compare two conditions from the same region of the brain, the power themselves give you some evaluation of the underlying neural's performance already. Then pairwise measure means that if you have signals recorded from different part of the brain and you can look at the relationship at different frequencies, you could potentially evaluate whether they have statistical interdependence or not. This is nothing but cross-spectrum normalized by the auto-spectrum, so to speak. And then this is the Granger causality. That is, I'm displaying a formula from 2 to 1. You can write a similar formula from 1 to 2.
What is H?
H is the transfer function in the previous slides.
Okay.
Is this. Okay, now this is our framework. So I'm going to demonstrate this on a few examples. That's another thing we physicists, former physicists, whatever, tend to do that is really perform this on the simplest possible model so we can understand everything fully. So I could call this analytical solvable system. So basically it's a very simple model. It's a little toy model. Yeah, it's a first order two variable autoregressive process. The first process is nothing but a white noise. But then this first process come in with a one time delay, begin to drive the Y process. Y itself for base autoregressive model one. So it's a very simple model. Once you specify the variance of this noise, everything in this system can be exactly solved. Whatever you need, you can got it by hand with a formula. So therefore, by construction, X is driving Y. And then by the model simplicity, we compute everything by hand. For example, the coherence between the process is 0.92. It's frequency independent because the process is just too simple. And the Granger from X to Y is 2.49, from Y to X is 0, because that's by construction. And here, then what we do is that we take this model, we begin to simulate it, numerically produce time series, and pretend it's the real data, apply our algorithm to it, and plot the result on this plot. So on this plot, I display coherence. This is coming from our algorithm. So this is analyzing the actual numerical simulation. This curve, if you superimpose the analytical value on this curve, they coincide. They are exactly the same. So therefore, this demonstrates that our algorithm at least doing something correct. And this also Granger is also correct. The thick curve, XT driving YT, which is 2.49, and the other one is 0. So therefore, we can recover the underlying patterns exactly with this very simple model.
Did you explain already what your other algorithm is?
I didn't. No. This you can just look at a green Gwicky's paper. Follow the steps. You get it.
Okay.
It's very simple.
But this.
Yeah.
Did you estimate the model?
Yeah, we did. Well, we estimated the model here. The model is so. What we did is that we simulate the equation output, then apply our analysis thing. We're going to future apply to real data. We take our algorithm, apply to the simulated data. Estimate a model using the formula, evaluate everything based on our estimation schemes.
Exactly the same. Now, the Granger index, what is the range?
Yeah. Oh, the Granger could be 0 to infinity.
So when it says you say it's 2.5 or 2.49, are we supposed to think it's a lot, it's a little? So what's the scale for this Granger index?
Oh, yeah, this is an excellent, excellent question. This, we have not yet, in the Gwicky's paper was considered so groundbreaking. Following that paper, there are full commentary on that paper written by the statistician of the time, like Arnold Zillner, and even by Parzan himself. They all wrote articles explain what this quantity actually means. This actually means is in terms of that variance explained. Remember, I displayed the formula. This will go back under in terms of variance explained. Yeah.
But when you say things that read, presumably this is when the data set. Some limit in which the data set goes. Suppose you only have a finite data set.
Oh, right, no. This is assume I can generate as much as I can.
Right,
until my model is so perfect.
So, but then the question to ask is how well it does on
the errors, yeah. I will come to the error estimation in a little bit.
Right.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, as the people come in, these people say, oh, this is such a simple model. It doesn't count. Okay, we just said, okay, we look at a slightly more complex one. So this is a slightly more complicated one. So it's like a model of a piece of a brain cortical tissue composed of multiple columns. Here we're representing each column by two populations, excitatory one, inhibitory one. They are coupled with one another. And then they coupled through long-distance axonal connections. So all these columns then compiled into one big system. You can tune all the couplings and make them into all kinds of network you want. Nowadays, networks are a very popular thing. You can connect them any way you like. Oh, scale-free or all kind of things. We play with this a lot. But in this case, what I'm going to do, all this, by the way, this is also coupled through nonlinear interactions, sigmoid functions. Then you have stochastic terms and so on. So then we just, the linear equation of pair is the intrinsic part, and then they are coupled with one another. Yeah.
Okay, so
the coupling is the sigmoid. The local dynamics is linear. Yeah.
Local dynamics.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
What's the QM
argument?
Q is the sigmoid function.
No, but QM as a second argument.
Oh, this is just the parameter.
Okay.
Yeah. So which is the in this talk, I'm just looking at the simplest thing. So I just take two of these columns and make the connectivity from one to the other non-zero, the other one is zero. So by setup, I have, again, a one driving two situation. But the only thing is that now I simulate this stochastic differential equation, I get data that's a little bit more complex than the little simulation model that I used earlier. So you can do that. Then you apply the algorithm to it again. This is the main result. So you have, this is the power spectrum. This shows, by choosing the parameters of this model, you can have oscillation at any frequency you want. So we have it around 50 hertz. This is from the two excited population, the two columns. We take two time series out. The red represented time series 2. The blue is time series 1. Keep in mind that the red is actually the receiving one. It has a higher power. The other, the blue, is the driving one. It has a lower power. But if you look at the Granger, if you look at the relation between them, it's very clear that the blue representing one driving 2. You see this big spectral shape. The red is 2 driving 1. It sits below threshold. This is empirically constructed threshold based on permutation test. This is a tricky thing. How do you do, in statistical analysis, you have no zero. There's nothing like zero. So you only can compute some kind of threshold. And computing a threshold in this situation, not all that straightforward. If you're interested, I can talk more about how to construct a threshold. But right now, I'm going to contend to show you that my red curve is below threshold. So again, I reconstructed my two patterns. That's one is driving 2, but 2 is not driving 1. So.
Are you measuring Y also? Or are you measuring
no, just the X. It doesn't matter which one you measure. It's the same. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it doesn't matter. Yeah?
Do you have any feel for if they are just reciprocally connected?
We have to look at the reciprocal couple. You're going to have both non-zero. I will show you data later on.
Can you give a sort of confidence level, like in physics?
This is confidence.
That's the confidence.
Oh, yeah, that's threshold, yes.
Uh-huh. So the number represents a confidence level.
That's just, so this means the threshold below that, you're statistically insignificant. Yeah.
Do you have any sense when you're getting the coefficients for the linear parameter?
Yeah, right. Yeah, in principle, it's least squares, but we use a slightly more sophisticated algorithm. It's a Burgess algorithm. There's an algorithm you can find. We invent nothing in here. We just copy what other people do. Then find the best one for us. We test different ones, find the one that's really most resisting bad situations, then that's the one for us. We invent nothing. Yeah.
There was a model of how the neurons are coupled used to generate this data.
Right.
Data,
yes.
Another model.
Yeah, fit the data based on our data model. Yes.
See, so the data model that you fit, yeah. Is it exactly of the same
form? No. The data model is purely assuming this is a stochastic time series.
Ah, okay.
Fitting a linear autoregressive model on that.
Linear autoregressive.
Yes, that's it.
And then from that estimation,
you derive all the quantities. Yes.
For typical neural data, how many coefficients do you actually need?
Well, I will get to that once I talk about the actual experiment. Now I'm ready for that. So I'm going to talk about some experiment situation applying this framework. The first experiment is related to beta oscillation in the sensory motor cortex in the behaving monkeys. Part of this result just been published this month, actually, in PNAS. We wrote a paper there and reporting some of the basic studies.
What does behaving mean? Does it actually active?
Yeah, behaving means because they are monkeys, you anesthetize.
Oh, okay.
All right, so then this is a monkey actually doing a job.
It's actually doing something.
Yeah, right. So sometimes called awake monkeys, mm-hmm. And but a weak monkey may not do a thing. You just record while the guy was, they're feeling drowsy or something. Mm-hmm. This is the guy actually doing a job. I'm going to describe the task mm-hmm. right here. So the task is a very standard visual motor go-no-go task. This experiment is done by Richard Nakamura at NIH. By the way, this data is 20 years old. It's embarrassing for us to talk about this, but we feel there's still so much in this. We really know very little about it. And it's still very unique in the sense that later on I will demonstrate the uniqueness of this data. We worked on this for 10 years. We know very little. So the task is the following. The monkey sits here, and once he feels ready, he will depress a mechanical lever. This is very standard in monkey neurophysiology. That is, you have to have the monkey, oh, this Andy's here, that's monkey physiology, so he knows all these things. So you usually, what you do is you depress a lever, then you hold it down to indicating that you are ready to perform a task. So then, this become very important for us to explain some of the results we observe. So they're holding down this lever. And then, a little bit time later, a stimulus will show up on the computer screen. The stimulus have four different configurations. Four dots lined up in a right slanting line, four dots lined up in a left slanting line, or four dots in this diamond configuration, slanting to the right, or got diamond slanting to the left. There are four different stimulus types presented on the screen. The monkey's task is not to discriminate orientation, instead discriminating whether it's a line or whether it's a diamond. So there are two categories that he had to discriminate. It's a line or it's a diamond. Then, based on the contingency of the particular experimental session, he has to say that if this is a line, that will trigger a go response. What that means is that the monkey then, remember, he depressed this lever and holding down to it. Releasing this lever, therefore, constitutes response. So if it's a go response, then he sees a line, then he's going to lift his hand rapidly, as fast as possible, of course, accurately. Then he will receive reward, which is it's a drop of water, because the guy was water deprived the prior day. So that's the incentive for him to perform, is to perform correctly and get water reward. And then if he sees a diamond that's randomly showing up on the screen, he will not do anything. He will hold on to this lever until the end of the experiment, and that's a correct response. So that's a no-go response. So you have a go response and a no-go response.
Will you still get a reward in that case?
Yeah, that's a good question. This experiment is asymmetrically rewarded. That is, he's only rewarded from the go response. If he correctly performed from the no-go response, no reward is given. This is called asymmetrically rewarded. Symmetrically reward means that whatever response, as long as it's correct, you get reward. This actually is very important for us later on, not in this talk, but later on in some interpretation of the findings we are having, because asymmetrical reward and a symmetrical reward tends to invoke different part of the brain.
So what happens away from lifting all the time, every time he sees any stimulus?
Yeah, that's a very good question. That is, if he lifts, he got no penalty anyway, right? But somehow he doesn't do that. the performance accuracy in this experiment is 92% or above. He's so well trained, he just does it correctly.
Yeah,
yes, absolutely. Absolutely. That's a very good point. I cannot answer to that because this is just the way that I've been presenting this data and how it's designed. I don't know why, without the reinforcement of a reward, he correctly performed those tasks. I just don't know.
What happens to the monkey if he releases the lever in the no-go trial?
He gets no reward.
But is there a delay until the next trial?
No, that trial is finished, and he got no reward.
But
yeah.
It's a typical time lag between trials.
Always have a lag time. Each trial, correct or not, has a delay time.
People, when they do asymmetric reward, they manipulate the time lag between trials.
Not in this experiment.
If he makes a mistake, even if he doesn't get the reward, he needs to wait longer for the next trial, which is when he has a chance of getting a reward.
And that
is the feedback for performing correctly, even in the
In many of these experiments, the reward and non-reward situation is the subject that they are interested in. Not here. This experiment is just a straightforward pattern discrimination, go, no go. The reward, no reward is not part of the design. So as far as I know, that's not being penalized in any way.
It's not clear what is the error message for the monkey that the lever should not be released in no-go trials.
No-go trials, but the thing is that for no-go trial, if he release, it does not get reward.
Well, there may have been
Right. Somehow he performs correctly. The only thing I can say to you is that he performed very accurately, both for no-go and the go trials. And what kept him performing good, I really don't know. Okay. Yeah, really, not going to write.
There's a training session.
Yeah.
When they're trained, then they do this task.
Right. Yeah.
So that would be my chance.
The other question is following a NOVO trial in which he keeps the liver depressed.
Right. No, there is a time period. After 500 milliseconds, then he can release it.
Okay.
Then the next trial will commence.
Before the next trial, he always releases it.
Oh, yeah, right. So he gets to move around a bit, and then the next trial starts.
Oh, okay.
Right. Okay, so, some of the time sequence, this pen's really out. Some of the time sequences are following. First of all, he depressed the lever, applying pressure, and the data recording commenced about 100 milliseconds before the time the stimulus being presented. Then the stimulus lasts for 100 milliseconds, and then he get a goal window, that is, he get some time window within which to perform the correct goal response. If he performed after that, too slow, not getting rewards. So he's pressured to really respond promptly and accurately. So I want to just demonstrate that the time scale involved in this and the kind of a temporal dynamics we'll be witnessing in this experiment. First of all, the monkey, once he depressed the lever, he began to gaze at the screen. So he's anticipating the onset of the stimulus. And then at time zero, stimulus being presented. After about 50 milliseconds, it arrived in the brain. So therefore, there's a sensory activation. Then he has to decide whether he needs to go or not go for that particular stimulus. Because on different days, the association is different. Today, line is go. Tomorrow, line is not go. So therefore, we can balance the stimulus and the response types. There are all these kind of things that to be involved. Once they decide to go or not go, it respond. Response could be either a releasing or holding on. So both are proper responses depending on the condition. All this will be finished within 400 milliseconds, very, very quickly in this case. The average reaction time in this case is 270, so.
How does the monkey know which path
to this? There's a training period. This you cannot ask me. I really don't know. There are monkey neurophysiology in the audience who might be able to tell you more. No, they can do very sophisticated tasks. This is a piece of cake for them. I mentioned that this is very old data, but it's very unique in the following sense. There are four subjects we looked at. Today I'm going to report just two of them, the top two. And the uniqueness of this data is in the following sense. That is, you look at each one of these black dots, that represent one electrode penetration. That is, all these dots represent simultaneously placed electrodes. So data are recorded from an entire hemisphere. This right hemisphere in this particular subject, left hemisphere in this subject. So data are simultaneously,
These are penetrating electrodes?
Those are bipolar wire electrodes.
Are they in the, under the, where about in the brain are they?
Right.
The surface of the skin?
Oh, yeah, it's only on.
Under the dura?
Oh, no, this is intracranial, directly in the cortex. Yeah, there's two tips. These are bipolar electrodes, two tips. One tip in...
What's helping the recording area?
There's up to 16 electrodes simultaneously, sometimes 14, sometimes 15.
How much exposed surface are there at the tips of the electrodes? And what's the separation between the bipolar?
The bipolar electrodes, the separation is about 200 microns that I know, but maybe a little more than that, maybe it's 1 millimeter. These details I really don't know. Yeah. So therefore, this many simultaneous recording really allowed us the opportunity to look at different part of the brain simultaneously performing. So give us a lot of opportunity to look at things that is still very difficult to do right now. So this is some single trial time traces from different electrodes. This is five electrodes. These are different trials. One thing I want to stress that
When you say different trials, different behavioral conditions, or
this represents same exact trial, same exact behavioral conditions, right? So one thing about this neurobiology is that the same experiment is often repeated hundreds and thousands of times. So there are same identical stimulation and response are recorded many, many times. So this really presented us the opportunity to collate all the data together as realizations of some kind of underlying ensemble. So this is some uniqueness into it, that is, in random processes, when you look at economics or weather forecasting, you get a process realized once, that's it. Here you can have that realized many, many times, so that's a little different.
Why is the second curve so different in the two
trials? That's tremendous variability in this.
Tremendous variability.
So in this particular study, what
same monkey, right?
Same monkey, from different days, they are so different.
Well, the trials are on different days.
No, this is a connected trials, but from one trial to the next, the brain responses can be very different. Tremendous variability in this whole thing. So what I'm going to present today, the main result is related. This is the stimulus onset, it's time zero, and then progresses forward. This is before the stimulus. I actually going to analyze this time period, about 100 millisecond time interval before the stimulus hits the brain. When the stimulus hits the brain, you evoke a response, as you can see. So we are looking at the spontaneous part of the brain. The reason we are looking at that is because at the time we are very influenced by some writings of Driver and Frith, and they were talking about the shifting baseline in the brain, how the brain is already engaging when the monkey is already looking at the screen and anticipating the onset of the stimulus. There's nothing going on yet, but internally he's already preparing himself for the incoming task. That is the question, can we analyze this spontaneous data to get some sense about what is going on in the brain? So then we applied our analysis framework to it. So again, I want to mention that the network analysis over a time period, it was minus 100 milliseconds to 20 milliseconds. That's before the stimulus actually hits the brain. So we are looking at the spontaneous activities. The traditional way of looking at this kind of experiment is to align up all the trials against the same stimulus and then perform an average. So those you are looking at the stimulus evoked activities. Here, we are looking at stimulus activity that has nothing to do with stimulus yet, just the brain's internal state.
But it's still aligned over the stimulus.
Aligned over stimulus, but before the stimulus actually hits the brain, so because the actual physiological response starts. So.
So how do you distinguish non-stationarity from variability?
Very good question. That we have. There are so many intricate issues here. Let me just start by saying that here we did some careful testing of stationarity and non-stationarity. We have chosen this pre-stimulus time period. One thing is very important is to say that whether the underlying brain is in a state that allow you to claim stationarity, whether the underlying brain is engaged in one state. So here the monkey is looking at the screen over a 100 millisecond time window. We assume it's more or less stationary. That's a very good question. That it always make assumptions, which is only approximately true.
So, about the recording, are these chronically implanted?
Yes, it's chronically implanted, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Can you say something more about this anticipation? The monkey actually knows the stimulus is coming?
Yes. He knows the coming, and he's so well prepared. He knows today's session, line is gold, diamond is not gold. He knows all this stuff. Okay. So, how to define this state more good. It's a tough issue. The next experiment, if I don't have time to go to it at all, if the next experiment I'm able to get to it, that's a more controlled over this time period. That is where attention is being controlled through the experimental manipulation. In this experiment, this part of the brain is freewheeling. You know, whatever is going on, we are just trying to see what's happening. So.
But he has trained the lever already, so he
yes.
knows from experience.
Yes. Yeah, he knows what's coming. The experimental design didn't put in a condition to carefully control that.
Wait, so the number of milliseconds after he presses the lever?
Then the stimulus comes on random intervals around 1 second.
Oh, random? Okay,
yeah,
so
it's a random, no. This is a random interval design. All right, so time is rapidly running out, so I better get time to talk about anything. I get a lot more, but anyhow. So then we sort of apply our framework to it. This is an MRI reconstruction of the brain. This is the actual MRI scan of the brain. And this all denotes the electrical locations. We found out there's a very interesting network of locations that's engaged in a coherent oscillatory activity. And this involves a motor site, somatosensory site, some posterior parietal locations. So for people who study this, they tend to carry specific connotation, what they do, and so on. They don't want to be important for us to look at that. And at the time we look at this, we have no clue what this thing is doing. And all we have done is look at power spectra and coherence. This connectivity is enabled because we compute a coherence between the two. That's about zero. So then it's significant. Therefore, we link them together.
So, are those parietal states 7A? I can't tell where they
Later on, I'll come to it. It's very important. You already know all this. So I'm going to show you some spectrum demonstrating where the power is concentrated. So there are two subjects we looked at. Both have the oscillation network in a similar kind of area. This is the power spectrum averaged over all the locations in monkey LU, This one is all the locations over monkey GE. So as you can see, the power all tends to aggregate about 20 hertz. So this is the beta range in the standard oscillation lingo. And if you look at the coherence over all the distinct pairs, average among them, again, you see the same aggregation over about 20 hertz. So it's a beta range oscillation. They're coherent with one another. Each one of them also shows
Is there some sense which monkey is more competent, quote unquote, or smarter or something?
I don't know. Well, they are monkeys, you just cannot train. That I know for a fact.
I see. But what monkey does better in coherence?
Well, that may not mean anything in terms of performance, right? Right.
This is really easy for all monkeys.
Right. This is such a simple task, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, sure.
What's the phase?
Oh.
You measure coherence. Did you look at the phase?
Phase. In our paper, we carefully compare phase. Phase means nothing. Let me just state that very bluntly.
Really?
Yes.
But is it zero?
If you want to look at phase progression using phase delay and advance as a way of evaluating relations,
no,
forget it.
Not
here.
I don't want to know that question. I just want to know what the phase is.
Phase is very close to zero. Very, all the pairs are close to zero, no matter what kind of relation they are having with one another. That's a very typical phenomenon in neurophysiology. If you look at two cells or two locations or field potentials, you look at the cross-correlation, they all peak at zero.
Right. Definitely.
Phase, we are engaging another battle with the phase people. I personally don't believe phase. Okay, this is some individual spectrums. I just want to show you that once we learn how to do Granger, we were well placed to see the outcome by applying to this data. So again, this is just choosing some specific locations. Where they are, it's not very important at the time. Just these two locations, they have a power about in the 20 hertz. If you look at the coherence, it's very high, 0.6, in the same range. But if you look at the Granger between these two locations, all of a sudden, it's unidirectional. That is, one direction, you get this big amplitude. The other direction is barely above zero. So it's very dramatic effect when you decompose them into directions. This is another pair of sites showing the similar kind of thing.
How do you interpret the frequency of the Granger causality?
I don't know how to interpret it. All we can say is that whether the frequency peaks in all three different measures occur in the same range or not.
So
whether 20 hertz means anything here, I don't know.
So what do you learn from the Granger causality spectra above what you learn from fitting the model? The
autoregressive models. This is all, by fitting the models, we derive this frequent spectrum.
Yes, but if I fitted the model X, fitted on previous values of X and previous values of Y, so
right.
I can tell if statistically the previous values of Y predict anything about X, I would
right.
know that from fitting the autoregressive model.
Right. Oh,
so,
well, I agree. What you're saying is that can we do this already in the time domain?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, you can. No question about that. But we want to know, when you do it in the time domain, we also want to know at which frequency this is happening the most.
Oh, right. That's why I'm asking.
Right.
Because
whether I learn anything about, right. Okay. That's a good point. That's a very good point. Right. One of the things we can learn is that to compare with the previous literature. I will talk about that. Previous people have looked at this, and the 20 hertz oscillation have been observed repeatedly occurring in this particular context. I will come to it. This diagram may not make a lot of sense to people who don't look at anatomy. So let me just directly jump to a schematic diagram. This is the schematic diagram we are able to extract from the two subjects we analyzed. Once we're able to see these arrows, remember at the beginning I said that we don't really know what is this oscillation doing here. All these neuron sites, they're oscillating together with this network. What is this oscillation doing? We really don't know. Then once we see these arrows pointing among these structures, this gives us a very good idea to hypothesizing. We now hypothesize that this network is nothing but supporting this lever depression, that is holding on to this lever. Later on, I'll provide a little bit of evidence supporting that notion. But now, let me just argue, based on all these different structures engaging this and the directionality among them, to reason why that might be the case. First of all, you can see that this is the somatosensory side. This is the cortical area where when I stimulate your skin and the cutaneous layer and so on, that's the part of the brain that responds to that. That's the somatosensory part of the cortex. And that's the motor cortex. That's sort of conceived as the output brain output pathway directing the muscles to do movement. And these two areas, the two posterior parietal areas, tend to be considered more higher level, say, association cortices. So I will come to each specific a little bit. The somatosensory area sitting in the center and directing all these others are very consistent with this task's nature. That is, keep in mind this task is like a holding on to something and maintain a steady pressure on that. So when you have to do that, this is sort of analogous to a closed loop control. That is, you have to have constant sensory feedback to know exactly how well you're performing with respect to your goals, and then constantly sending out motor output to adjust for possible relaxation or possible mistakes you're making in this maintenance. This actually, I would like to recite a patient study that we found that's published in 1982 by the British group in London. And they found a very famous patient. I'm running out of time. Apologize for. Don't worry about time. Yeah, so because there are questions, so I am excused from that. I'm already worried about that. So anyway, if you are interested, I can keep going. Then this patient name is G.O. He suffered a very acute case of a neuropathy. He lost all the sensory input, none. He feel nothing. But his motor output is completely intact. He's able to move ballistically from A to B with no problem at all. But he cannot perform fine motor, and he cannot maintain any stance. So without, they did a demonstration for that that's very interesting. They have asked this particular patient to pick up a suitcase and hold on to it. Now he's able to pick it up. This is the ballistic part of it. So visually, you guided your hand to pick it up. But he cannot hold on to it.
Is he proprioception?
Yeah, not all of that is gone, because there's no sensory feedback at all. Now proprioceptions are all gone. So he can pick it up, but cannot hold on to it, unless he look at his hand. If he's looking, then he can manage. But if he's not looking, he drops it right away. So this gives us a very good indication empirically saying that really to hold on to something, you really need a constant sensory update of the current status of things in order for the motor system to keep your muscle tone in place, to keep this thing steady, a closed loop control. So therefore we say, oh, this guy sitting in the center, makes some sense in that regard. Another one is this one, area 7B that Bruno was asking. Area 7B is part of the parietal cortex. Area 7B is known to have the following function. It's primarily a somatosensory area, and it's very important in terms of a non-visually guided movement. Non-visually guided movement. So in this case, the monkey really depressing this, he's looking at the screen, so he's not visually guiding it. So therefore, also another thing is that this part of the parietal cortex is intensively interconnected with the cerebellum. So we are hypothesizing, this is just speculation, that this and the cerebellum may be teamed together to represent the current goal. That is, the current goal is holding onto this lever and maintain a constant pressure. Don't let it slip. That's our speculative storytelling. So if you find this wild, that's okay. So I find this wild too.
Do you have the size and the strength of those connections?
We have all the magnitude in our paper. I didn't have it here. Okay. I should have plotted the magnitude here.
It's maybe a little bit surprising to me that somatosensory cortex has an input to 7A.
Oh, no, hold on, I come to it. Thank you very much to anticipate my next thought. So that's an excellent question. So the somatosensory, therefore, so what we're thinking this connection is doing here is the following. Somatosensory providing the update of the current actual situation. And this area, since it holds the goal, computes an error signal. That is not the current performance, and it has the ideal performance. So the difference is what's to be minimized. Then he sends a signal to the motor cortex to output to correct all these problems. That error signal, that's what we think. The area 7A, I'll come back to this. Area 7A, we only have one animal has an area in 7A. That's why I label this white. But these yellow ones are present in both monkeys. Yes, Andy?
So built into this, you have the strength of the causal, but you have the time lag too, right?
Right. So time lag in what sense?
Well, that you have something happening in one of these nodes, and then it takes a while for it to
Right.
So for instance, you would expect that if you have a motor output, that's going to change your sensory input. So in a way,
Yeah.
You would expect there to be an arrow back.
Yeah, that's a very good question. That is whether the motor cortex, when they send the stuff down to the muscles, there are also sensing mechanisms that send stuff back. That,
even at a longer length,
right,
you move your arm,
right,
you change your
this position. May very well be the possibility that our data is so short, we're not able to capture delays that's beyond our window. That's very possible.
How many legs were you taking into account?
No, our analysis window is 120 milliseconds long.
Okay, single bin analysis, right? I mean, you didn't multi-bin it and then do like a moving average? Or
No, just the one bin, everything's in there.
You have no time lag.
No.
Well,
right.
But you're doing a frequency decomposition in this frequency domain.
Right.
So you have phase at every frequency.
Phase, yeah. Then let me come to that. The phases, if we look at the phases between these different locations at this frequency, they're all close to zero.
Close to zero. So
very
that's
close to
no time lag.
Right. Well, I mean, it's the things that the phase, you see, this, I must come to this. That is phase, people think about phase is directly related to the amount of time delay. That's really not that exact correspondence. Because the only case where phase and the time delay can be related in an unequivocal way is when the signal just directly passively transmitting without any local processing. If any local dynamics take the signal, process it, phase loss is a direct relation with the distance traveled.
But all the phases are essentially zero.
Yes.
Which is a pretty interesting.
Singer, they have seen this, Rolf Sommer, they published a paper in Nature. They have seen very close to zero phases in cats.
Yeah, correlations are almost always centered.
Right. That's very much the reflection of that fact. So that's why I feel phase is really ambiguous.
Well, I mean, it would be tough to, I mean, you're talking the time delay to go between these structures is 10 milliseconds, and you're looking at a 20 hertz signal, right?
10 milliseconds, why 10 milliseconds? We have a 100 millisecond window.
No. The conduction delay from another is 10 milliseconds.
Uh-huh.
So you're looking at 20 hertz signals, which have 50 milliseconds, window. So you're looking at, one-tenth of a sine wave. So
what do you
figure out
I didn't understand.
The phase is of such a
short. No, I don't understand what you're saying. Why you're saying there's only one-tenth of a cycle? The window is 100 millisecond long. That allows two cycles in there.
No, I know that. No, I'm saying, but the frequencies you're interested in.
Oh, okay.
24 hertz, 20 hertz.
Oh,
right?
Okay.
The natural wavelength of those.
Yes.
In
it's 50 milliseconds, right.
Right. It's very, very long compared to the amount of time it takes to go from there.
That's true.
So
it could be not resolvable. May not be resolvable.
It's not resolvable. Oh,
yeah. That's a possibility, too, that I cannot say with definitiveness.
So, having fit that model, you now have a estimate for what's the deterministic component that is related to activity in other areas and the
not the whole thing is modeled as a random process.
Well, there is so you have X is predicted by previous values of X and
Y, which
comes from other areas.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a noise term.
Yes.
So how big is that noise term compared to all the other terms?
Oh, that's a good question. I didn't really print out. I don't know. We potentially have that information within our algorithm because that's one of the variables we estimate, the variance of the error term.
Because that will tell experimentalists how many trials they have to do in order to sort of average out that.
Oh, yeah. That's a very interesting point. We have so many trials. We're really blessed. We don't really have to worry about that. We have sufficient data.
That goes back to my earlier question about choosing N and K.
That's right. Right.
You choose on a model that goes back one or two times.
No, it tends to be in field potential. Right.
The question of what is the amplitude of what you call the noise, which is whatever is left over, versus the amplitude.
Right.
Deterministic components that you're including could depend initially on how far back into the past you're looking at the deterministic part of your model.
Empirically speaking, the model order, well, we apply all the Akaiki, all the standard model selection criteria. But I can tell you, they don't really work that well. So empirically speaking, the model order is on the order of 10 in our case. Our data is sampled at 200 hertz. So therefore, our model order encompasses about 50 milliseconds, the model order.
I have a question about the mental component. If I'm still correcting the pairwise comparison, so
this is all pairwise results.
So can you discriminate whether the arrow, say, from stomach to motor goes straight or through the interaction?
Okay. Good, I come to this. Okay, if I have time, if I'm allowed, that's the same question that Bruno was asking.
Can you predict the behavior based upon just the response in the motor electrode?
Predict the behavior in what sense? I have some slides on behavior.
When the monkey's going to like raise his
paw. Oh yeah, I'll show you this result. Right, coming up.
Can you predict it just based upon the signal you're recording in the motor? Like
how soon he will release? Whether it's an early release or later release?
Yeah.
That's another excellent question. We have done that.
Pre-stimulus,
you can correlate that with the reaction time. That's what he's talking about. Yeah, right. That we have done that.
But you're making certain claims about things being right. Computed in different areas. Can you make concrete, can you do any concrete analyses to say, yes, this is computing a difference?
Bruno, let me say this. In this task, there's no further manipulation we can do anymore. So we are really tied down by what we can do. Yes, so this is really, so yeah. Let me just continue on with the one final thing. I talk about what this structure is involved, what this structure might be involved. Another very important thing is the previous literature. People have studied the motor cortex and the pyramidal tract, which is the motor cortex, not motor cortex, after talking with Andy. This pyramidal tract is a big bundle of axons going to the spinal cord, then from the spinal cord, then send down to all the muscles. And this motor cortex, people have recorded from this, when the animals are doing a constant pressure in holding. That Roger Lemon's group have done, Donahue's group have done, people have done this. And they are able to show that when the animals are engaging in these activities, the brain oscillates at 20 hertz. So that's exactly consistent with the oscillation that we are seeing as well. So therefore, but what we are able to see is that the more broadly how the network can be extended to much broader areas, not just the motor cortex per se. So.
You have all these other, not to keep interrupting, but do you never see any connections from like visual cortex?
To this network?
Yeah.
No. No. That we know.
So I have sort of a philosophical question. Is that you established all this in a certain epoch before stimulus even occurred. Now, I don't see any reason why these arrows couldn't change as you go further on.
Of course, it could. I will show you this whole network just dissolve. I show you a slide in the next thing. The whole network will dissolve. So let me make a hypothesis, then we'll come back to the question. So this our hypothesis then, based on what we have seen, is that this beta oscillation network we've seen earlier supports this level of depression. Again, I want to say that this post hoc analysis, we cannot go back to careful testing anymore, but there's one condition in this experiment that would allow us to provide some kind of a indirect evidence supporting this hypothesis. That is, remember this monkey, as I said, prior people have shown that when the monkeys are holding down a lever, maintain steady pressure, 20 hertz oscillation. When the monkey releases, oscillation goes away. So therefore, if our hypothesis is correct, then there's a comparison we can make. That is, when the monkeys are doing a go trial, he will release this lever very soon after the stimulus. In a no-go trial, he will hold on to the lever until very, very end. So therefore, if the lever depression is the reason that this oscillation exists, when he releases, oscillation should go away. When he holds on, oscillation could continue. So that will give us a comparison that will allow us to evaluate whether that's indeed the case. So therefore, we perform a time course analysis with the 80 millisecond moving windows and a go versus no-go. So I'll show you.
Whether it's coding actually for reward anticipation?
Whether it's
reward anticipation, right? No, it's not getting rewarded in the no-go.
Right. That's.
No, he's not.
He's not being rewarded.
It's asymmetrically rewarded, right? In the no-go trial, he's not rewarded.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. That could just be reward anticipation, right?
It could be, but in the no-go trials, why it continues if it's reward anticipation? So. It goes away means what? Goes away, I mean, he's continued to anticipate, or I don't know.
I guess
that possibility exists. I cannot refute it based on what I have, but I strongly, I don't know. That I cannot answer that question. That's possible, I cannot answer that. I don't know. So this is the result we have performed. So this is the spectrogram. So what we do is that we move an analysis window. And this is the frequency, that's time, and this the spectral power is color-coded. So as you can see for the no-go trials, this 20 hertz oscillation indeed terminated before the mean reaction time, that's the arrow pointing here. While for the no-go trials, it kept going all the way to the end. So this to us, some kind of circumstantial evidence at least consistent with this particular hypothesis.
What's the vertical axis now? Itself?
Vertical axis is the frequency.
No, I mean the coming out of the page, 100 is like coherence?
No, that's power. The power, yeah, this is non-normalized power. Forget the what magnitude means. It's only relatively.
Okay.
Yeah. I want to show you the Granger's time course. This is very striking. If you look at cemental sensory to motor, the cemental sensory to motor, remember, before cemental sensory driving motor. This driving exists and then terminates, and it goes all the way to the end in the no-go trials. If you look at the reverse direction, nothing is happening. So it just shows you the unidirectionality between these two locations. I must talk about this because there are two questions coming to this. That is, I need to talk about a little bit about this conditional Granger causality. This is come to me. The reason can be motivated by this theoretical plot. If you look at these two plots, A drives B, B drives C, A also drives C. The other plot, A drive B, B drive C, that's it. There's a missing link. But if you perform a pairwise analysis, just pairwise analysis, you cannot separate these two cases. Because if you look at A and C together, you will see this indirect link as reflected as A driving C. You cannot separate them apart. So therefore, that presents a problem for pairwise analysis. So therefore, the way to deal with this is a conditional Granger. There's a way to deal with this. I'm running out of time, so let me just mention. Okay, but anyway, let me mention why we care about this problem in this particular situation, as the question has arisen. That is, I take the diagram from the previous four-side diagram, just looking at that three-side one, because the motor is on the receiving end, so I'm just deleted that. Just look at these three. And the question came up, that is, whether there should be a cemental sensory 7A link. So in other words, whether this diagram should be just this, and this direction could be due to our methodology, not able to completing the analysis. There's a reason to suspect that. I'm sure there are lots of motor people in the audience. They've seen this many times. This is the anatomical plot from Feldman Van Nassen 1991's review article. In that paper, they have two big maps in the brain. This is all anatomical maps. One is the visual map, the other is the sensory motor map. I want to show you that this, I only apologize for the poor quality of this thing. The lower part is the zooming part of the diagram. The lower part is really the cemental sensory cortex per se, the S1. So that area, as you can see, the 7B is here, but 7A is a loner, sits on this corner. It's only linked to 7B, not directly to the cemental sensory cortex. So the question arose as to whether this interaction that we're seeing is actually mediated through this. So therefore, based on this, we come up with the hypothesis. We say that possibly the cemental sensory driving to the posterior parietal 7A is really mediated by the 7B. So we postulate this hypothesis. Then we perform the Granger conditional Granger causality. So this blue represents unconditioned driving, just pairwise. You can see this is a very large effects. But once we condition on 7B, it's like removing 7B, all of a sudden this drop to threshold levels, slightly above, but very, very close to threshold levels. If we do a control over the other guys, I can do all pairwise condition the third one, all pairwise condition on third one, right? I can do those. This cemental sensory driving 7B and the condition on 7A barely budged. There's no difference. This one has a little decline, but the threshold is here, way above the threshold. So in a way, through this conditional one, we probably can say that this probably is a more correct diagram where this direction is due to a pairwise analysis method.
I have a question. Yeah. You do the conditional in your model, right?
Yeah, there's a methodology to do it. Yeah, I didn't talk about it. Yes, right. Yeah.
How about the raw data, right?
No. You have to do the data in a separate way. You have to do it separately. Yes. Yeah, how to do this correctly? I want to comment on this. Guicke himself, he's the guy who did the 1982 paper. In 1984, he came up with a conditional method. It turns out that method doesn't work. We tried, and we got all kind of bad results, negative numbers. Then we actually did some original work here, that we did something to make it work. So that this is our only conditional, original contribution in the methodology part. Okay, I think I better stop. I have a very interesting talk on attention, but I think I should stop. It's such a long time already. I talked about almost an hour and a half. So if you're interested, I can present some of the attention. Oh, just to show you this movie, just to make you smile. I want to show you an attention movie just to demonstrate. I found this movie very, very intriguing. I'm going to show you just demonstrating why attention is such an important effect. Yeah, so you can see that there's this harbor, those of you who have seen this, please don't say anything, just like the other people. So there's a boat and the boy sitting in the thing. Then I'm going to play this film. You'll see two pictures alternating rapidly. These two pictures are essentially the same, but with one very important difference. The question is, can you tell where the difference is? This highlight sort of, when you know where to attend, you will see the difference. But if you don't know, that's difficult to see. If you have seen this, please don't say anything. Sort of when I see this first, it's difficult for me to see. But if I point out, so once you know where to look. So anyway, so this is kind of fun, I think. But anyway, so I'm done. Thank you. Yeah.
I don't know much about the electrophysiology part of it, but the fact that you managed to construct this quite sensible sounding schematic from one neuron in each area.
One neuron, no. We don't recall from one neuron. It's just a population. It's a field potential.
Oh, okay. So that's representative of...
that's a population activity.
Oh, sure. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
I actually have questions, the same question that I had before on the method and the question of terminology.
Yeah.
The way that Anthony talked about Granger causality wasn't quite like this.
Oh, it's,
Well,
it's the same.
I understand, well, it's just regression, right?
Yes.
You have X's and Y's.
Yeah.
And the X's in the regression, or you put the Y's in, so you add one variable on that. So it's a regression.
Right. Yes.
Okay. Because, I mean, the way that it's defined according to Anthony, which has reviewed the paper, is you have to measure the whole universe.
Oh, the universe.
And then you see the effect of dropping that one particular variable that you're interested in and see if you actually increase the variance of the
region. That's right.
But you could interpret it this way.
Yeah. The same interpretation. Yeah.
You say, well, the universe is Y alone or Y with X, you're dropping X.
Sure.
Right. It's the same thing.
A very restricted definition of universe. And when Andrew talked last week, we discussed that the universe is, in an experimental research, is whatever you can measure.
Yeah. Right.
The only thing that you are not measuring is not the universe. So if you're not measuring only two things.
Thank you. I'm just saying it's a question of terminology. That's called regression in statistics, but that's fine.
Yeah.
But it's a specific kind of regression because you're allowing for only causal models. Whereas in attention analysis, you wouldn't necessarily have to allow for only causal models.
Mm-hmm. No, but I mean, Margaret is right. And the point you were making earlier was that you were saying also, why look at this particular measure? Why don't I just simply look at how big the coefficients are in my linear regression model once I include this additional dependence? Mm-hmm. And so I guess this is just to be able to give one number, right, that summarizes the effect.
It was just a comment. The method is beautiful. I love the Granger spectra. I think it's neat. It's just that it's based on regression. That's all.
No question. It's based on regression. I agree.
The thing that I was saying before, I mean, what really does it buy me on top of what I would do with regression? Because, for example, we've talked about time lags. Imagine that I can predict Y at time t based on Y t minus 1, t minus 2, t minus 3. And same for x's, but the coefficients on x t minus 1 and x t minus 2 are not significantly different from 0, which I can test using regression.
Right. Yes.
But that the coefficient on x t minus 3 is actually significantly different from 0, then I know that my x has an influence on y at
like 3. Yes. Yes, very good point.
There must be something more to.
Yes. In our case, we are not getting to that. That is, which particular leg the coefficient is non-zero. Actually, we were thinking about doing that too. But we are, the coefficient for us will be lumped into the spectral decomposition. The reason we were sort of so bogged down in this spectral version of things. So I agree with you. I think this is very informative information, whether at which leg the coefficient is began to be non-zero. That's a very important information.
But I would know also if I had relationships one way or the other. So I don't.
Right.
I
agree with you.
Okay.
I agree with you. I think those are additional information are important. We were thinking of, we've been talking about doing that for a long time. That is, looking at all the coefficients, which one are the most significant. That's very,
so
that will provide additional information.
So if you wanted to sell the method to me, what would you say? Is it more robust in some way, or is it?
Oh. Well, this method, I'm not trying to, no, what do you mean?
No, I'm just saying, give me a reason why I should use it, is what I'm saying.
Oh.
I'm not trying to be mean.
Okay, no, I think your question is completely legitimate, completely. Now, for us, it played the following role. That is, we see a network, we don't know what's going on. I don't know, we don't have any initial inkling about how to proceed with it. Once we have the direction, at least we can guess why this network is there. What might be its functionality? Then we can proceed with some additional testing based on this initial realization. That's one thing. Secondly, I'm not getting to it, it's my next experiment we're analyzing this attention situation. This gives us a way to testing a hypothesis from a different way, allowing us to look at top-down control of attention, whether different layers of the cortex interacting with one another, and so on.
But if I kind of understand,
yeah.
Another thing is, why do this in the frequency domain versus the time domain?
Yeah.
So
that's yes.
Classically, if you're looking at field potentials,
right.
You like the frequency domain. That's sort of a classic thing.
Right.
But what I'm wondering is, could you do the same
in time domain?
Could you look at the appearance or power and consider that as a variable in a time domain?
Yeah, of course.
You fit a time domain model, right?
Yeah, fit time domain. Of course, everything. Of course, this whole thing. The starting point is all time domain. Then you have to work real hard to find a spectral representation for that. So therefore, we are actually doing the actual thing. But
if I may, what is appealing about staying in the frequency domain? To me, at least, it was very appealing when you showed these plots, where you look, for instance, at what the coherence is doing.
Right. Yes. Right.
So when you see the difference between the goal and the no-go task in the coherence coefficient as a function of time.
Which is you know, this is it. It is a spectrum dance. You need the frequency analysis, and then you compare that with his range of measures. So I think it's appealing to be able to have everything in the frequency domain when you're looking at the appearance. I know it's an oscillation, less than 20 hertz range. You know, I know that this is observed in the system. Oh yeah, but the 20 hertz range for the range of causality spectra doesn't seem to be meaningful. So I understand that physicists are used to looking at spectra and frequency domain, find that appealing. I'm used to time domain.
No,
and
but exactly. Excuse me. What do you mean it's not meaningful? I would have been very surprised if he has all the power of his signal in the 20 hertz, and then his Granger measure came at the 500 hertz. That would have been, totally unusual, unexpected.
That's true.
So the fact that it's in the same frequency domain, in the same frequency range, I think.
Yeah, it's meaningful.
Exactly.
Yeah.
This is the frequency range of the signals that are contributing to
the phenomenon. Yeah, I agree.
So
I think
why do you say it's meaningless?
Right.
That's
perfectly fine. This is I think the time domain, frequency domain debate is not just with respect to this. I think that's a long-standing. People, the frequency people and the time domain people has been battling one another for a long. I know. I'm completely sympathetic to that. But we were just so doing so much spectral things. Yeah.
But it's fine. You misunderstood me. I'm not rejecting it. I'm just wondering.
No, no.
That's. I have to learn something.
I think that you want this incentive why you should invest your time doing this. Yeah. I think I don't know whether I could convince you very thoroughly. It's really. But I want to mention one thing that in spectral analysis this seems to be convincing. That is, sometimes your event happens at a frequency where the power is very small. So if you look at the time domain, where your data is really dominated by the frequencies where the power is dominant, you might miss that little event. That's one little thing that could be. On the other hand, as I said, relating this finding to the previous work, whether there's such a lineage of doing spectral decomposition and doing things. So for us to relate our work to others, is also being made easier by this possibility. I this is the kind of defense I can have.
It used to be a lot faster, I think, because you could do the fast Fourier transform. So I think, you know, maybe
this is easy.
The 70s people did this a lot because inverting really large major centers is difficult. So we have all this history.
Oh, this is it.
Yeah,
that's a question.
Did you check for situations when you have a causal relation, the construction, but the method breaks down? So what are the limits of the method?
Oh, gee. Well, the limits of method in one case, okay, there are two places. One is that when the signal is truly nonlinear, then you have a problem. I have an example later on in my experiment three. I cooked up some nonlinear systems and generated the data, fit the linear model to it, it breaks down. It predicts nothing. Then I have to extend it to in the nonlinear domain that we can do. That's not hard. The hardest part, this bothers me day in and day out and every day, and it should bother all of us, is the problem of a measurement error modeling. That is statistically called measurement error modeling. That is, when you put a sensor into your brain and you're thinking you are picking up the phenomena you want to examine, 24-hour oscillation engaging in this maintenance of task, but usually you're picking up things that's unrelated to that. Those unrelated parts in statistics, call that the measurement errors. This stuff will fail miserably if that magnitude is too large. Give you an example. I create create a model situation, like my autoregressive model with X drive Y. I produce the data. I fit my model, I recover the underlying patterns of connectivity. But if I collect data in the form of those two time series with a lot of noise thrown on top as my recording, then analyze the results, anything is possible. So the question is, what is the real thing? That's really a big problem. So that is a bigger problem than anything else.
But that's true, it's more than anything.
Yes. Yeah, that's true. That's just true. But in this case, it's particularly sensitive to that. And I mean, this is when we began to do this multivariate analysis, whether coherence or Granger, anything, our results believability will rely on how much we know about how the purity of data, what's the composition of that. And that's a big problem. We're trying to work on something. We work on something related to a common filter kind of approach. It seemed to improve this a little bit, but we don't know for sure. But this is a big problem.
So there's also...
I was just going to ask, an interest I have is, you know, so you can record single units and record field pairs. I'm going to show some problems tomorrow when I talk. Is there a way that we could use this Granger causality to show that single units actually produce the field potentials and vice versa?
Right.
Can you take something
That's a very good question. We look at that. We have looked at this problem, but we look at this, we didn't get any good thing. We got miserable results. What we did is that, I didn't present this. Actually, for those of you who are interested, I just published a paper on how this measurement error can disrupt multivariate analysis. There, I used this partial coherence as an example. There's another causal approach that I haven't mentioned that Gersh proposed in the 1970s using partial coherence as a way to identify drivers of oscillatory activities. He has done that. That method fails badly if the measurement error is even anything. So what we did there is that we took a rat, this is just an anisotized rat, recorded from three structures, from the anterior thalamus, from hippocampus, from retrosplenial cortex. This recording, the anterior thalamus is a single unit recording, just spike trains, and the hippocampus and the cortex are both EEGs, just field potentials. Three simultaneous signals, mixture of both. So we want to look at the relation. You know, this is related to the theta rhythm and all this stuff. It's just a mess.
Single units from all three spots?
No. Single units only in anterior thalamus, field potential from the other two sides.
How about on the same, because you can record single units and field potentials on the same electrode.
Right, I know, but in this case, we just didn't. You see, that's our limitation is we don't do the experiment ourselves. We have to live with whatever is available. So that's why we are limited.
And the other question is, have you ever looked above 100 hertz in your field potential data?
We haven't. We just don't have confidence. The data can have burst in all kinds of frequencies. We don't know. We extremely conservative, even though we talk about this Granger seem to be far-fetched, the kind of thing. But we only work in oscillatory domains where there's a lot of known things. So that we are not too
I would look from 100 to 200.
Yeah, without anything. Oh, yes, we have seen that.
Okay.
We have seen that. High frequency bursts in the high 150, 200 hertz range, we have seen that. I've heard people talking about 500 hertz. I've heard, but I don't know. I mean, but we have not studied them. We have no clue what they are doing, and we don't know what's going on.
Yeah, so there's a generalization where you replace cross correlations by mutual information, and
yeah.
A guy called Triber has proposed to use that to determine directionality. Is there,
yeah.
Are there any practical
that's
constraints
a,
that
no,
make
that's
it
a very, very, very good point. This has been done in the time domain. The Granger correlation in the time domain is very similar to this directed mutual information. After all, it's just conditional probability. All this thing, you know, condition on previous things, and you just use a conditional probability framework that immediately get connected to the information theory.
But you don't have to do linear modeling.
Right, there is completely modeling, but you have to assume a Gaussian distribution, because otherwise,
computationally,
yeah, computationally, you have to do that. So again, that's very similar to a time domain thing. We have done some of the comparison like this in the past, but we're so sort of invested in this spectral representation the way, yeah. Yes.
What can this tell you more than just looking at the connections in the brain, just looking at neural anatomy?
Because you can see neural anatomy, you know, we take that, we use quite a lot of that trying to guide our analysis, but not always the right way. Actually, I have some slides in the next talk. The anatomy sometimes give us good guidance, sometimes it didn't. I don't have a good sense when systems are functionally talking to one another, how is the underlying anatomy constraining that? Because after all, if you allow enough intermediate stations, everybody's connected to everybody else.
So the thing that this technique would allow you to do is basically say, you may well have this known structure, but maybe for a given function, you're not using.
Right. Oh, absolutely true. Absolutely true. I mean, the brain is so fluid.
The other seems to be true, too. You know, when you were showing that isolated station of 7A sitting way out on the chart.
Yes.
Well, that's 10 years ago. I'm sure people, you know, if they looked hard enough, they would find connections.
Something. Exactly right. Exactly right. But that just happens to agree with our subsequent analysis. So I'm happy with the 1991. So. So.
Do I need infinite amounts of data to estimate information non-parametrically?
Non-parametric, don't even think about it.
No, because there is always the argument that your thing is parametric, you need a model, I need a model, but information doesn't need model.
That need model, of course.
I mean, you to compute the mutual information, you need to estimate probability densities.
Right.
The estimation of the probability density is going to be, more or less.
So
better
or
worse, according to whether you have more or less data.
Right.
Right.
Same
and the time lag sort of makes it significantly
so
harder.
Yes. This is more high dimensional distribution estimation. That's with this much.
Yes.
That's just not the way. Unless you make a Gaussian assumption. That otherwise, I don't think you can do it.
So there is not. It is not free lunch.
The 20 hertz, this is like a characteristic time scale of about, say, 50 milliseconds.
Yeah, so that's one cycle, right.
Right. So would this be like a time scale, I don't know, of something that you can identify physiologically? Say, for example,
I don't know.
Feedback
no.
To, something
emotional. I have asked some somatosensory guys about what 20 hertz editing means. They gave me all kinds of receptor things. I couldn't figure out, so I can't repeat them.
Thank you.
Thank you.